This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us. And a reminder that coming later in the show, we'll talk with sports writer Jim Kleinpeter about the passing of Y.E. Tittle and the LSU football fortunes. And we're going to hear from Melissa Silva and Tara Wicker about a major event coming this week regarding mental health. But we begin with one of our favorite guests, the maestro Tim Muffett, 18 seasons now as music director and conductor of the Baton Rouge Symphony, a tenure longer than any other. He appears with prominent orchestras around the country, but Tim is, of course, in our midst for much of the year. And this week, there is something new called Bachtoberfest. Bachtoberfest. Tell about us that? About Bachtoberfest.
Well, Bachtoberfest is exactly what it sounds like. We've got beer and bratwurst and Bach, and it's going to be a really fun program. Great music. It's uncompromisingly wonderful music, but we have a very special setting at the State Museum downtown. It'll be an outdoor program underneath the great, right by the reflecting pool in the great plaza. Which I think is going to be acoustically wonderful and visually stimulating, and we're looking forward to it.
Fabulous. And the Baton Rouge Symphony is a treasure in our community, and we're at a time when nonprofits have been hit hard, but the symphony has plodded along and has done so with great fanfare. And every year you have tremendous events, and this is the one for October. And it's a new idea. Whose concept was this?
Well, this is an idea that came up from a conversation with myself and our former executive director, Carrie Bird. It's not enough to just do concerts at the River Center Theater and say, everybody come to our concerts. It's in the 21st century, we really need, if we want to broaden our impact and our interface, we need to reach out and we need to try some new things. From my perspective, I also love partnering with organizations that are really special, and that certainly is the State Museum. The State Museum is is one of the great jewels, I think, in the community, and I'm amazed at how many of our fellow Baton Rougeans have not been. And it's just such a great encapsulation of Louisiana culture. And so we're excited to partner with them in this production, and we're excited also to repackage what we're doing. And I think that's I've always been proud of the Baton Rouge Symphony's ability to assess the demand of the community and what might try something new. We're just being a little bit more aggressive with that now in the coming years and kind of reinventing ourselves a little bit, how we put it out there. And this is a manifestation of that.
Your number, if you'd like to talk to Maestro Muffett, and our time with him is 297-5633 in Baton Rouge, 877-217-5757 elsewhere, and you can send an email, talk@talklouisiana.org. The Baton Rouge Symphony Orchestra, chamber players at the Capitol Park Museum, October 13th, that's this Friday, and it is at the State Museum, and for those who would like to go, is it a special thing where you have to make special preparations, or do you just do the usual thing and go to brso.org?
You can go to brso.org. You can call the office at 383-0500, and we'll be happy to get you fixed up for this. It's a casual program, so no need to get dressed up for this one. But as I said in the beginning, it is uncompromisingly great music, and we have two of the Bach Brandenburg concertos on there. We have the concerto for two violins, but then also some of the perennial favorites, the Toccata and Fugue in D minor for organ. Dick Webb, our symphony organist, will be playing that very famous piece, which is also seasonally appropriate. And the Jesu Joy of Man's Desiring, and many of the greatest hits of this composer. So it's a really interesting program, and the audience should really enjoy it.
Well, Tim Muffett, born in Bridgeport, began playing the piano at 7, and next month you'll have one of the top pianists in the world.
You know, I think, Jim, that may be the first time that my piano playing has been used in the same sentence as Jeremy Denk's piano playing, and they do not belong in the same concept. But yes, we're very excited about the November concert. Jeremy Denk is one of the most sought-after concert pianists around today, the winner of a MacArthur Foundation Genius Award, Musical America Musician of the Year, an extraordinary musician, pianist, and communicator about music as well. He's a very special individual and a wonderful, wonderful player.
That's next month. That will be November 16th. And then in December, you have your usual holiday fair.
December's a big month for us. We have our Home for the Holidays program, which is at the River Center Theater. We have our Holiday Brass Concert, which the main stage of that is the St. Joseph's Cathedral downtown, but we also take that program out to other locations throughout the parish. Actually, it's one of our great outreach programs. We do our annual partnership with Baton Rouge Ballet Theater for the Nutcracker, which we're very proud of that. That's been going on for many years now, and we love that partnership. So December's a great month to be a musician.
Mm-hmm. How do you keep it fresh after 18 years?
Well, you know, by always trying to keep our finger on the pulse of the community and serving the community the best that we can and making sometimes small adjustments to what we do and sometimes large ones. I would say Bachtoberfest is a pretty big mm-hmm. adjustment. This is unlike any program we've done before. We've done outdoor programs. You know, our collaboration with the Rural Life Museum would fall into that category. But this one's a little bit different. And so, you know, always keeping our roots firmly planted in the greatness of the music and preserving the integrity of that, but also trying to reach out in new and innovative ways keeps it exciting every day, Jim.
And we've talked about this before, but you like all kinds of music.
I do like all kinds of music. Duke Ellington said it best, there are two kinds of music, great music and the other kind.
But there's more of the other kind.
Well, there may be, yes. But there's great music in every genre, I think, or in every style, mm-hmm. I should say. And I appreciate all kinds of great music.
Well, when you were growing up, you had this classical background quite early in life, but did you listen to pop music as well?
Of course.
Yeah?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's important that for the 21st century musician, we can't be in a silo, because for us to have the best impact on our community, we have to go out and meet people where they are. And so it's important that I have an understanding of our constituency that love country music, or our constituency that loves hip-hop, or our constituency that loves the heavy metal of the mm-hmm. 70s. It'll help me in communicating with them if I have an understanding of their music. So I think today's musicians should be well-versed in everything's out there as much as possible.
So when you were growing up in Bridgeport, who were some of the major influences?
Well, early on, my biggest influence was my sister. My sister's 10 years older than I am, and she is also a professional musician and had a very distinguished career as a teacher of music, and still does. And so she had music in the house for me, and that was a huge impact. And she really, I owe a lot to her. And then I was also the product of superb public school music programs, and that really helped nurture some budding talent.
Public school.
Public school,
public
yes.
school.
Right.
Is that kind of process still going on in public schools in the United States?
It's dwindling. There are bastions of excellence out there in some places, but certainly as budgets are cut, arts get cut, and it's sad because, you know, arts programs are not there to create professional musicians and professional artists. They exist to create well-rounded people and solid citizens. And the arts are a great vector for understanding and a great vector for learning. And so it's disappointing to see those go out of the schools, but in some places.
Now, in this Bachtoberfest presentation coming Friday, how many members of the symphony will be there? Will you have the full gang?
No. This is a chamber concert. This is part of our Lamar Family Chamber Series, which is a wonderful partnership that we've had with the Lamar Foundation for many years, and we're most appreciative of it. They've made it possible for us to do some extraordinary things over the years in the realm of chamber music. And so this will be typical Baroque era forces. So when we're talking about the Baroque, we're talking about the music from about 1600 to 1750. And so it's small. When the Baroque orchestra may have had 15 players in it, so our largest group will be small. It's chamber music. And sometimes down to one player. We have a Bach cello suite with our principal cellist, Molly Goforth, be playing one work.
Well, it's this Friday, brso.org, if you'd like more information about Bachtoberfest. It is an outdoor concert.
Covered. It's a covered program.
And so if it rains, you're covered.
If we're very well covered. You know, that venue's got a wonderful roof on it. But if it starts blowing sideways, as it does, we'll go indoors.
Okay. Well, thank you, Tim Muffet. Good luck, and we'll talk again soon.
Thanks.
Appreciate it. We're back after this pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us. 877-217-5757 is your number. And if you're dialing locally, 297-5633. We've talked about crime in our community to some extent on this program over the last many months. But one of the issues that is certainly involved in crime and in other facets of our society is mental health. And we have the executive director of the Mental Health Association of Baton Rouge, Melissa Silva, and Councilwoman Tara Wicker with us. And there is a major focus on this Thursday, 6 p.m. at the Leo Butler Center on Washington Street in Baton Rouge. And let's begin with you, Melissa Silva. This is something that a lot of people don't like to talk about. It's not a very pleasant subject, but mental health is certainly a factor in our society as we know it all over the country, the world, but here in Baton Rouge.
Good morning. Yes, it's a big issue affecting our community, as well as across the United States. There's, you know, over 43 million people that are affected with some diagnosable mental illness every year.
Tara Wicker, this is something that is near and dear to you as well.
Most definitely. I mean, we've had to deal with this issue, especially in a lot of our urbanized communities where individuals are, you know, literally let out on the street, the decrease in mental health resources and the availability of services has posed a huge problem for us just as a community as a whole, and we're seeing the impacts and the effects of it on crime and our community.
All right. And let's see if we can get Tara to a better spot. She's a bit muddled right now. 877-217-5757 is your number, and 297-5633 in Baton Rouge. As far as this particular event on Thursday night, Melissa, what will you be focusing upon?
The title of the event is Mental Health 911 Families in Crisis. One of the issues that we've discovered in our communities is there is a lack of knowledge, as Tara just spoke of, also resources. We find that a lot of families really have not a great understanding of what's out there to help them when they do have families with mental health issues. So this event is, we're really sponsoring a couple of these throughout the year in different pockets of the community. That is a resource for the families. Where can I go when I have a loved one in crisis?
Tara, how do you draw a link, if any, and I'm sure there is a link, but how significant is it between crime and mental health issues in our community?
I mean, I think it's really significant. When you don't have, you know, resources that are there for individuals that are battling with mental health issues and actually getting them to the services that they need, they end up quite oftentimes on the street committing sometimes petty crime and then sometimes major crimes based on the fact that they just don't have access to resources and availability of things that will help them, you know, just live a productive life. And, you know, we run into it literally on a daily basis where we have individuals that are calling us or calling our office saying, you know, I need access to quality housing. Can you help me, you know, figure out how to get a job that would be suitable to my needs? And so the unfortunate thing and the heart-wrenching thing is that there's such a lack of resources and the availability of services that we have to oftentimes turn people away or try to figure out, you know, what's the next best thing for them to do in the interim. So it's really hard.
The number for us is 297-5633. This event is at the Leo Butler Community Center, 6 o'clock Thursday, and it is with the Mental Health Association, and the executive director is with us, Melissa Silva, and Tara Wicker, the veteran councilwoman, who's going to be with us as well for a few more minutes. So if you have some questions, we can talk about mental health intervention protocols. This is something you're going to be focusing upon. Quite often, people who have these issues, Melissa, they get thrown in jail. Is that the best way to address somebody who has a mental health condition?
Unfortunately, no. But I think that's a big issue within our community. You know, over half the inmates in our jails and our prison systems have mental health issues and oftentimes co-occurring disorders, which means that they may have a mental health and a substance abuse issue. And it's because of some of the lack of resources that we have that these difficult clients and individuals can often wind up in our jail systems. It's not the best case. It's definitely not what our community needs. We recognize that there's a lack of some of these resources, and I think the community is trying to make some strides to change that and to improve the services that we have.
At the council level, Councilwoman Wicker, how can you address these kinds of issues, if at all?
I mean, some of the things that, of course, we've attempted to do in the past was the passing of the mental health PACs, you know, trying to get that information out into the community and making sure that people are aware that this is a crisis that doesn't just impact, you know, one part of our community or our society. It impacts all of us. And there's been so many just horrific stories of individuals that have mental health issues, ended up in jail, and in some cases have even died. And, you know, it's those kinds of stories that, you know, it's very unfortunate, but we're also hoping that brings awareness to individuals in the community that this is a real crisis. You know, after the flood, we saw the mental health cases rise. You know, people who had never experienced mental health stress and those issues all of a sudden found themselves in a place that, you know, was unprecedented for all of us, really. And so that extra stress and pressure on the already scarce resources that were available for mental health crisis became even more evident. So I think from our perspective, it's both education, making sure people are aware, and then pushing policy that would allow for there to be some systemic change without resources, without, you know, funding sources and in adequate services, we're kind of like the hamster on the wheel, just going around in circles.
Melissa, do people generally get the help they need? Do they seek it out, or is it something that goes maybe undetected or untreated for some time before it's addressed?
In many cases, mental health issues will be undiagnosable and untreated. There's such a stigma that surrounds mental health issues that creates the fear for people reaching out to get the help that they need. One of the things that the Mental Health Association does is try to empower folks with mental illness and mental health issues to get the assistance they need. Our programs and our services definitely help support that. You know, it's not a shameful event in your life. There's, you know, when you look at the numbers that are affected, it's 1 in 4 people that have some type of disorder that affects their mental health. It's if we can continue to educate and advocate for those in the community, I think we can help make a difference. I think that the stigma is less than it used to be. I think we're making strides in that, but there's still a segment of our community members that still shy away from it and do not want to receive the treatment.
One in four people.
Wow.
Tara, that's a big number.
It is. It's a big number. And, you know, I was thinking about this yesterday. Every year I usually attend the Butterfly Society's domestic violence event. And, you know, and I just really believe that part of what we're dealing with in terms of even our increase that we're seeing in domestic violence cases and in things that go along those lines are just those are instances and issues that have gone for a long time untreated, and people are just not aware or don't have access to those resources. And it's more people than, you know, we really think or I think even care to admit that are going through those issues. And, I totally agree. I don't think that it's anything that people need to be ashamed about, but we got to recognize that it's an issue.
877-217-5757 is your number. 297-5633 in Baton Rouge. The email is talk@talklouisiana.org. Our guests are Melissa Silva. She's the executive director of the Mental Health Association of Greater Baton Rouge, and Councilwoman Tara Wicker. They're here talking about mental health in our community and an event this Thursday. And we're back after the news with Karen Henderson on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us. Emily Gunn is producing today. Coming later, Jim Kleinpeter, veteran sports writer, but we're continuing our discussion with Tara Wicker, East Baton Rouge Parish Metro Council person, and Melissa Silva, the executive director of the Mental Health Association for Greater Baton Rouge. We've talked about crime, and Baton Rouge has had 58 murders in less than 200 days. 58 is the number that the New York Times used yesterday to show how crime is affecting us all over the country. 58 people died in Las Vegas a week ago Sunday. And in Baton Rouge, we're one of 20 communities in the United States and the smallest of the 20 to have 58 murders within the last 200 days. Tara Wicker, how many of those do you think have issues of mental health that are part of the reason why people are dying in such large numbers in our community?
I mean, I'm not, at all a mental health expert, but by far, I think that when you look at the totality of the circumstance and the way that those senseless crimes were committed, in my opinion, they weren't committed in a way that it was sort of, fast action, or I have an opportunity here to get something from someone. These were, well thought out, systematic, planned events, which to me is a clear indicator that was something that had gone definitely wrong in that person's mental state that allowed them to progressively get to that point. And I just think about even the young man that was on Facebook that killed the elderly gentleman not long ago. And I remember him, and he worked in the industry, and he talked about how, there were so many cues and so many signs. He had been trying to tell people over and over that he was going through this and he was stressed out, and, no one seemed to listen. So I think that in those instances and looking at how they happened, I think many of those individuals had issues with mental health.
877-217-5757 for Tara Wicker and Melissa Silva. Phil in Baton Rouge. Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Good morning, Jim. I know it seems like there's this kind of, subjective idea or perception that that it's kind of like a Wild West in some of these shootings that happen every weekend. But can you talk about what happens to someone when they shoot, after, what they go through? I mean, what is that? Just how awful is that? I mean, murder is the one of the worst crimes you can commit. Do you get to talk to? Are there? I'm sorry, I'm getting a little awkward here, but just what is it? What it is not an easy thing or an incredibly, it's an incredibly hard thing to do, to kill someone else.
All right, as far as the ideas that are in the minds of people who commit crimes. Do you deal with that at all, Melissa?
No, I don't.
Well, Tara Wicker, you have dealt with crime for some time.
Right, you know, and not had a real opportunity to speak with the individuals that have committed the crimes. But one of the things that we're doing here more recently is we're actually doing a talk show with the families of the victims of crime, just to talk about the impact that it's had. Because I think people forget that, and I think his point is well taken. There's a residual impact not only to that person, but to that person's families and to the community. That's sort of a larger picture of that puts all of us in this space that we're very uncomfortable. So we're talking to these moms that have lost, you know, children due to violence, but you know, and I'm really interested in the families. Oftentimes, we'll see on television the family members of the individuals that have committed those crimes, and you know, and some they'll tell you, you know, we just didn't know what to do. We knew that he had an issue. We knew that he was suffering, or that she was having problems, but we just couldn't help him. And you know, you hear their heart going out, but you know, it's a sad, sad case, and it's an issue that we've got to be able to be okay with standing up and addressing as a community, as a collective. We never know when it's going to hit any of us.
Leslie on Essen. Leslie, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana with Melissa Silva and Tara Wicker. Hi, Leslie.
Hi, good morning, everybody. Mental health is a very broad term, and I'm a little worried because, for instance, schizophrenic people in general are not violent. So we don't want to include, you know, everyone in mental health. People with substance abuse problems have mental health problems. Sociopaths who do a lot of the killing, that's a mental health problem. So it's a very broad term, and I'm wondering if maybe that might concern people about the wrong population. In other words, it's not schizophrenics who were doing this sort of stuff.
Okay. Right. Melissa? Thank you, Leslie.
I think that's a great point. We stress a lot that, you know, not all folks that have a mental health diagnosis are violent or aggressive. And sometimes that can be portrayed. But if you're receiving the treatment and the therapies, and at oftentimes the medication that you need to treat your disease, you can be a functioning member and a productive member of the community. So that's a very good point.
I'd like to chime in on that, if I may, Jim, for a moment. You know, my husband and I also pastor a church, and it was very ironic because, you know, just last night we had a counseling session with, you know, a young lady and her husband, and as they were sitting there, she told me, you know, this was her diagnosis. Now, this is a young lady who you look at every day, and she has the most beautiful smile you can ever imagine, very pleasant, gets along with everyone, but there's a side that she told us last night that says, you know, I get very, very angry, and, you know, and so I think, again, part of that process is that education piece, having those venues where people can come and actually talk through those issues. One may need medication, and one may just need, I just need an outlet. I need someone to hear that I've been hurt in my past and I've been hurt in my life. And these are the things that I'm going through. And if they're not addressed, you know, I may end up in a violent situation. So I think you're right. Everybody is not, you know, violent, but if we don't identify, we don't address it, it can progressively get to that point if it's untreated.
All right, 877-217-5757, and talk@talklouisiana.org. A few more minutes with Melissa Silva and Tara Wicker, and this is a question from Isaac about the Crisis Intervention Center and the phone. Is that something that's helpful in our community in addressing these kinds of issues?
Yes, I think that having that resource in our community is a benefit for many. Folks may not always have the courage to reach out and present physically to discuss their issues, but making sometimes even an anonymous phone call to the crisis center to discuss the issues that they are having is a benefit. Though oftentimes those calls will divert crisis, help individuals work through a difficult time that they may be experiencing, and to move them in the right direction.
877-217-5757, the number. Angela in Gonzales. Angela, you're on with Tara Wicker and Melissa Silver. Silva.
Hi, good morning, lady. Hi, good morning. How are you guys doing?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Great. You know, I understand mental illness, but there's a problem with too many people using that as an outlet or a scapegoat. A lot of the violence, I'm a 25-year veteran, and, you know, me and a lot of my friends suffer from light depression to severe depression. A lot of us have PTSD. A lot of the people that we go to in group counselings and different things have been labeled either with a mental illness or a mental handicap. But society is labeling that as everybody has a problem as a scapegoat. The basic thing comes down knowing right from wrong and learning how to control yourself. And that's taught in the home. That's taught, you know, not allowing children to have tantrums. There are truly people that have mental health issues, but that everyday average Joe that's committing some of these violent crimes are being allowed to use that, and that is being associated with people that have real mental issues as a negative. And that it's not right and it's not fair. What the media is doing and then where medical is trying to do, you know, they're blurring those lines.
All right. Thank you, Angela. Mm-hmm. Melissa?
You know, it's very hard for both Tara and I to comment on incidents of crime within our community and across this nation, as we're not always aware of what that person may or may not be diagnosed. I think that you do have to sort through the media and the both positive and negative things that are being said when some of these incidents happen, in regards to what the crime and the deaths and the incidents of this mass murders that are happening. So for us to sit here and say that we totally understand and truly understand everyone's motive and where they are in their life or what their diagnosis may or not be is difficult. We can, you know, we can here in the community try to continue to educate and offer the resources that we know that our community needs. You know, we see such an uptake in the instances of crime, but also just the lack of the resources and the services that some of the most needy and the most crucial populations in our community need.
We'll spend a few more minutes with Tara Wicker and Melissa Silva, and there is time to get in under the wire, 877-217-5757, and we'll also hear from sports writer Jim Kleinpeter right here on Talk Louisiana, back after this pause on 89.3 W. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us. Emily Gunn is our producer. The show is Talk Louisiana, and your number is 877-217-5757. On deck is sports writer Jim Kleinpeter, but we're wrapping it up with Councilwoman Tara Wicker and Melissa Silva of the Mental Health Association of Greater Baton Rouge. The association is hosting an event Thursday, 6 o'clock, Leo Butler Center, Families in Crisis, Health Mental Health 911. That's the title of the event. Bruce and Walden. Bruce, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Yeah, hey, Jim. I'll be brief. You all have an ally. I was waiting for you to mention it. The Department of Justice found the state of Louisiana in violation of the Americans with Disabilities Act for illegally confining 4,000 people with serious mental illness in nursing homes. And they're threatening a suit, which would probably be about $800 million, which would enormously enhance the community system. I mean, you're doomed if you just rely on bureaucrats in the state or the legislature. The federal government's going to have to weigh in on the incredible dearth of mental health services in the state. But
all right. Thank you, Bruce. Tara, your thoughts.
I'm so glad he said that. That was a great segue in what I wanted to mention from the previous caller as well. You know, DOJ has been a great ally for us. Councilman Trey Welch and I last year started the Police Policy Review Committee. And, you know, one of the first issues that came up in that those community meetings was the issue of mental health. And the recommendation said that mental health needs to be at the forefront of police policy issues and policing and be a part of the patrol, be a part of the team so that we can make sure that we can identify those individuals that may have mental health issues versus those individuals that may just be, you know, opportunists and committing crimes. So I think he's absolutely right that we have to be able to utilize every resource that's available to us to deal and handle with this issue.
Well, thank you for joining us, Tara Wicker and Melissa Silva. It's been a pleasure. And once again, Thursday, 6 o'clock, Leo Butler Center, right here in Baton Rouge on Washington Street. And for more information, you can call 225-772-3383. That's 225-772-3383. We're joined now by Jim Kleinpeter, the veteran sports writer who recently left the Times-Picayune and NOLA.com. After how many years, Jim?
33 years at the Times-Picayune.
33 years. And you and I go back to our days together at Louisiana State University, and that's a focus of our conversation right now. The Tigers play Saturday at home against Auburn, a 2:30 kickoff. And Ed Orgeron, he was on the ropes last week but pulled out a win against the University of Florida. How's it looking for Coach O right now?
Well, a lot has changed in just a week. They played much better. And I think a bigger concern, at least from my point of view, for LSU fans, was the way he reacted immediately after that game, that loss to Troy. You know, you're going to lose some games that you should win, but he had some curious statements that you don't usually hear from a coach. But he seems to have gotten his feet back under him, at least from getting the team to play well and bounce back. He showed that last year with the way they bounced back from losing to Alabama to really crush Arkansas. But we'll find out this week. We'll find out if he can keep it up. It's just very, very hard to stay on track in a job with that much pressure.
Well, LSU is about a touchdown underdog. When you say curious statements, what do you mean regarding statements made by the coach last week?
Well, I mean, right after the game, he's saying that he was surprised that a third-string running back was running the ball. And I don't know, in that statement to me, he's throwing three people under the bus, the running back, the offensive coordinator, and the running backs coach. It was just the kind of thing that, I don't know, maybe a lack of experience that you make that statement. If he just doesn't say that, you know, I don't remember Les Miles was good at not throwing his players under the bus. And if you do that sometimes, it causes some problems that you don't need in the locker room. And then later in the week, talking about not having any kickers, I didn't think that was a very smart thing to say. Now, I don't know, maybe he got it all straight and, you know, having a meeting with the AD and the two coordinators, I don't know what that was about, but that's the kind of stuff that would worry me if I was an LSU fan.
Yeah, it looked like almost a panic situation last week.
Yeah, and people don't realize, you know, there's all this media covering the team, but we don't see. We see about maybe 15% to 20% of what's there. We don't see the practices when they really get down and dirty. We don't see the meetings between the players and the coaches. There's just so much we don't see that all we can do is make our best guess. And sometimes coaches will say things that'll be like a tell to what's going on, but I can't ever recall the AD, two coordinators, and head coach having a meeting before.
Now, a listener notes that after last year's loss to Florida, that Coach O, he kind of threw Darius Geis under the bus, didn't he? Didn't he say ran the wrong way on the final play?
Yeah, and, you know, sometimes I think a carefully placed comment like that sometimes can do you some good. It's like if you're trying to get through to somebody and they're not listening, and I'm talking about a player and a coach, sometimes a coach might do that. Nick Saban did the same thing to Josh Booty back after the UAB game. And I know a little bit about the background of that, and sometimes those are a good idea if you're trying to get a point across to somebody who's not receiving the information the way he should. So that I kind of forgive that that time. But, you know, he was being honest. So
now the athletic director also was getting some heat and still is, Joe Oliva, for giving Coach O a $12 million buyout. If they fire him, they're going to have to pay him a whole lot of money. And there weren't a lot of people knocking on Ed Orgeron's door to hire him. Why did he get a $12 million? Actually, well, it was 15. It's gone down to $12 million. But why did he get such a substantial buyout clause?
I'm still stuck on why Les Miles got a gigantic buyout back when he got it, because I don't think there was nearly the interest in him that that warranted that gigantic. And when I first saw it, I thought I must be mistaken. And so, but I wasn't. It was huge. This is just as bad. You're right. I mean, Ed Orgeron would have taken anything, I think, to get the job, and they could have worked out something later that was a little more fair. But I don't think, and don't get me wrong, the things Ed said were curious, but I don't think he should be fired. I think you can't fire him now. That would just make it even more embarrassing, you know, what has happened. So you got to give him 3 years or 4 years before you start talking about the hot seat. And, you know, he does some things really well. Supposedly he was going to stay out of the offensive game plan, and of course he violated that already. But yeah, I think Joe Oliva, I mean, somebody needs to look at whether or not he should be retained. He's the one more on the hot seat than Ed Orgeron right now.
On another topic, Sunday night, an LSU great, Y.E. Tittle, one of three LSU Tigers in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. He died at 91 in Stanford, California. He had an amazing career, one of those guys who peaked in his late 30s, Jim Kleinfeder.
Yeah, an amazing guy. He was a highly regarded talent. You know the story about how LSU kidnapped him and got him away from Texas. And this was a guy a lot like Billy Cannon, one of those people that he walks into the room and he's the alpha dog as soon as he walks into the room. I remember going out to San Francisco to cover the World Cup, and everywhere I drove, I saw Y.A. Tittle Real Estate, Y.A. Tittle Financial. He was a very wealthy man, one of those people that succeeds at whatever he does, and one of the people LSU should be proud to have, and maybe even consider having a statue. They seem to be handing out statues lately.
Put him in the Ring of Honor in the stadium.
Absolutely. Absolutely. He should be there.
Yeah, well, and he was quite a college player as well, from 44 to 47. He laughed that the most notable play in his LSU tenure was tripping over his pants as he was about to score the winning points against Ole Miss, but his belt buckle broke. In those days, they actually wore belts.
Yeah, I've heard that story, and I've read about it in Peter Finney's book. And it just one of the classic, another in the long line of storied Ole Miss incidents, LSU Ole Miss games.
Yeah,
the winning touchdown, not just a touchdown, but
the
winning, could have won the game.
And they ended up losing 20-18. Now, the most iconic photograph in the history of the NFL is that of Yelberton Abraham Tittle.
Oh yeah, you know, you stare at the picture, and it encompasses the early NFL, the NFL of the 50s, and maybe a little bit the early 60s. What it was like? It was just a brutal game. You know, they beat each other up. They didn't have the union. They didn't have all the safeguards. There were no targeting or anything like that. And it kind of brought that to in one picture, encompassed it.
Thank you, Jim Kleinpeter, and thanks for listening. We'll be back tomorrow. Stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.